From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1959 when a pair of physicists published an article with a title that got the attention of the science world, Searching for Interstellar Communications. The authors argued that radio telescopes had become advanced enough to pick up alien transmissions. A year later, astrophysicist Frank Drake set out to find one. He spent 6 hours a day scanning frequencies. He found essentially nothing. But a few months later, Drake helped construct an equation designed to offer an estimate of the number of active and communicative civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy. And while the range of possibilities is broad, Drake himself said in 2012, his own estimate, his best guess, is that there are around 10,000 active intelligent civilizations in our galaxy. But now, more than 50 years after the Drake equation was created, it has been modified using new information and ideas. And the co-author of this new paper modifying the Drake equation is Adam Frank, University of Rochester astrophysicist. Adam Frank built on the foundation created by Drake, and he asked a new question. You see, Drake was asking, how many active intelligent civilizations are out there right now? Adam Frank is asking, how many intelligent civilizations have there ever been? And the conclusion is that we are almost certainly not alone, if you're an optimist, at least not unique as intelligent beings. You might disagree, given your level of optimism or pessimism about certain parameters, but it is a tantalizing intellectual exercise, and Adam Frank's paper on the subject was just published in the journal Astrobiology. So let's talk about how we can determine whether we are alone or unique. I'm thrilled to welcome back Adam Frank. Congratulations on the publication of the paper. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here again.
Well, Frank Drake is, you know, you go back, he's in his 80s now, and I love watching him still talk about this. He talks to SETI. We're going to hear from him in just a minute. When did you first hear about the Drake equation? Did it make any sense to you, or did you think, come on, you can't put parameters on how many civilizations are out there?
I think the first time I learned about the Drake equation was probably when I was an undergraduate taking intro astronomy. And, you know, it comes up, and there's always the section in that intro astronomy course where you talk about life. And that was the first time I was introduced to it. And I think, you know, the important thing about the Drake equation, what they were doing was they were trying to, as someone said, quantify their ignorance. It's not an equation in the sense of like Newton's equation where you derive that, you know, gravity is proportional to how far away you are. It's more a way of formulating the problem that breaks it up into the specific parts that if you knew this part and you knew that part and you knew that part, you know, all the way down, then you'd have the answer. So what it really does is just it helps you sort of figure out what questions you have to ask to get the answer of how many intelligent civilizations there are we can communicate with.
And sure. And so in 1961, Drake, my understanding is he essentially put 7 parameters in. And these are the kinds of things, some of them are obvious to even the lay folks like me. How many planets are out there? How many stars are out there? How many planets would be in a habitable zone? Those kind of questions. And then there were some other factors as well. And I think it's also important to point out, and I'm sure Adam will say this as well, Frank Drake was never trying to say, the answer is 28. You know, I mean, like, it's not like he was trying to...
42.
You're not going to come... It's always 42. I should have said 42. I missed an opening there. But he wasn't trying to put a firm number on it. And to some in the science world, they thought, well, this is silly. But he's saying, this is an intellectual exercise to get us thinking broadly. It's not to come up with the actual number.
And that's actually where it came from. What happened was is that I think it was the National Association for Science or whatever it was at that time said, hey, we should have a meeting on this. Frank, you want to have a meeting? Could you put together a meeting? And so really the equation came from him getting 20 or 30 people together and saying and organizing the meeting around the equation. Like he formulated his way, okay, on day one, we're going to talk about the first term. On day two, you know, so what he really meant it to do was a way of breaking the problem down into chunks. That's what a physicist does, into chunks that then you can then talk about each individual piece.
So if you want to hear a little bit of what Frank Drake says now, this is what he told SETI in 2012 about these parameters and what has changed in the 50 years. And this is an important clip because it's not only Frank Drake talking about some of the parameters in his own equation going back to 1961, but Adam Frank's modification of that equation. I think you're going to learn a lot about some of the limitations and why Adam has kind of changed the way we look at it. Let's listen to what Frank Drake told SETI.
The accuracy is dependent on the factor which is least well known. And unfortunately, that one, which is the longevity of civilizations in a detectable state, is still unknown and will be till we detect other civilizations. So we have that problem that we still have one factor with a large error bar on it. But some of the others are really very well known, which they weren't 51 years ago. The only one that was known 51 years ago was the rate of star formation. And that one has been improved somewhat, but it hasn't changed greatly over 51 years. One of the key ones was what fraction of stars have planets. And there, of course, you all know of the great breakthrough, the monumental discoveries of the last 10 years, which I think history will look back upon as one of the greatest advances in the history of astronomy and science in general.
I want to work backwards there. So Frank Drake is saying in the intervening 50 plus years, we know some things more accurately than we did when he was creating the equation. Yes, Adam Frank?
Not just beyond more accurately. We had no idea what the answer was back then, particularly about planets. We had, you know, it was a 2,000-year-old problem. You can see the Greeks talking about, are there any other stars in the sky that have planets? So for 2,000 years, nobody knew what the answer to that was. And now we know it. We've nailed it.
And there's a lot.
Yeah, basically, you know, every star you see in the sky, we can say pretty clearly that every star you see in the sky has a family of planets around it, or at least one planet going around it.
It's incredible.
It's incredible. It's insane.
I mean, the number, and we're going to talk about some numbers that will start to boggle your mind. But so those are the things that we know much better than when Frank Drake was putting this equation together. But at the beginning of that comment, he was saying the longevity of the average intelligent civilization, we don't know. And that's important. That's important why, Adam?
Well, it's important. I mean, first of all, it's for, you know, the equation. So let's be clear about exactly what Drake was looking for. He was trying to find what we call N sub C, which is the number of civilizations that are out there right now that we could have radio communication with. So he was, you know, asking a very specific kind of question about extraterrestrial intelligence. And so, you know, the last term in that was the longevity of, you know, how long does, on average, does a civilization last? Now, what's the interesting thing about that is exactly the problem we're running into right now with climate change, right? It's not at all clear whether or not a civilization like ours, which, you know, pumps out so much energy, it begins to feed back on the planet, is like, you know, is 200 years, is that it? 200 years? Does everybody get 200 years and, you know, pretty much that's the end? Or do you somehow figure out how to get through to, you know, a million years or so? So, you know, it's both relevant for the answer to Frank's question and it's relevant to like, oh, wow, we're actually running into this right now.
So interesting to me because when you think about, well, at least the idea that we're not alone. And if you believe we're not alone, then you have to believe that eventually civilizations die out. And is it climate change? And we've talked about that in this program in the past. And I encourage you, look up much of Adam Frank's work. He's on Cosmos and Culture, the blog on NPR's blog 13.7. He writes about climate quite often. He's written for the New York Times about whether climate is the great filter. All stuff worth reading and seeking out on your own. But your work in modifying this equation kind of takes the longevity out to some degree because Frank Drake is asking, how many are out there right now? You've kind of turned it around to say, how many have ever existed, right?
Right. And see, the thing is that we had to do that, right? I mean, because, you know, science is not about necessarily answering the question you want to answer. It's about answering the question you can answer, right? Science is about using the data you have and then figuring out how you can leverage that data to say something interesting. So if you have to keep that average lifetime in the equation, then there's nothing, you know, there's nothing you can do. Now, so let me just back off for a second. So this idea that over the past 50 years, we have discovered, we've now actually nailed all the terms in the Drake equation that have to do with just astronomy. Those are the first three terms. The rate of star formation, how many stars form per year, the fraction of those stars that have planets, and then the number of planets around any of those systems that have planets that are in the right place, what we call the habitable zone, where basically we think the temperature is just right for life to form. So all of those terms are now, I mean, it's just mind-blowing. We now know those numbers. And even, you know, 20 years ago, we didn't know those numbers. So that is a revolution in astronomy. That's a revolution in human understanding. And what I wanted to do with my collaborator, Woody Sullivan, is figure out, well, how do we, you know, what can we do with this? How can we, you know, use this new data to say something that couldn't have been said before? And what we figured out was the question you have to ask that you can answer is, how many civilizations have ever existed, or at least put limits, you know, probability. We can talk about probabilities. What can we do with, we can somehow constrain the probabilities for how many civilizations have ever existed. They may all be gone by now, but, You know, that was the question. And if I could just say, when we talk about, when we ask, are we alone? There's two ways to ask that. Are we alone now? Or are we alone in the sense that we're the first time and the only time in the whole history of the universe that sentience, that intelligence has ever evolved? And to me, actually, they're equally interesting.
So I would say, are we alone or are we unique? Right?
Yeah, that's right. That's a nice way of putting it.
Okay. So what did you have to do here? You know, what did you have to do to create these new parameters?
You know, what's amazing is it was really trivial, right? This is actually, in my own, you know, lifetime in doing science, I've written, you know, lots and lots of scientific papers about, you know, stars forming and stars dying and everything. And this was actually the thing that I'm most proud of, but it was actually trivial to do because really, I kind of just had to divide two numbers by each other to get what I needed. What we did basically is we took this data, right? We took the numbers that we actually knew. And then we said, okay, let's get rid of asking how long they last. And once we realized that when we did that, what we would get out was actually the number of civilizations that ever existed. And then we said, okay, let's take all those probabilities about, you know, so here's the other three terms in the Drake equation. There is the probability that a given planet has life forming on it, the probability that that planet that has life, evolves up to intelligence, and then the probability that that intelligence goes on to create a technological civilization. So all three of those terms, either one, any of those, we have no idea what they are. We just have no idea. There's some science that can kind of guide speculation, but basically we're clueless. So we combined them all into one, and we call it the biotechnical probability. That's the probability that you take a habitable zone planet, a planet that's in the right place for life, and it goes all the way up to forming a civilization. And so then we said, okay, I want to know what's the limits on that probability such that we're the only time it's ever happened, right? So that the number of civilizations that are formed is one, right? Us. And what we found, so what we were basically doing, we call this the pessimism line, right? If you're pessimistic about life in the universe, you can't get more pessimistic than saying we're the only one that's happened. So what this number, this biotechnical probability limit gives
get
us.
Get ready for this number.
Yeah,
this is crazy.
It tells you how bad the odds would have to be in order for us to be the only time it's happened. And it turns out to be 1 in 10 billion trillion. Right? 1 in 10 billion trillion.
How many zeros is that?
That is 10 to the minus 22, right? 0.22 zeros and then a 1, right? So here's a way to think about it. Here's a good way to think about it. In order for us to be the only civilization, only time in the entire history of the universe that a civilization, that life has formed and gone on to intelligence, it's like, imagine I gave you a bag of planets, right? A bag of planets, and these are not just any kind of planets. Not like Mercury, which is like right up against the sun. These are all planets that are like Earth or in the right place.
Goldilocks zone planets.
Goldilocks zone planets. What we're saying is, in order for us to be the only time this has ever happened, you'd have to go through 10 billion trillion planets, like, you know, picking them out of the bag, nope, before you got to us, right? And so that number is so small, or that, you know, that probability is so crazy that of course it's happened before. Like, even if you were pessimistic, nobody's that pessimistic.
Well, some.
You know, when you look at the astronomy literature, this is what's interesting. So, you know, there's people have been arguing about the Drake equation for a long time. And in general, when someone's pessimistic, they'll say like, oh, you know, the odds are 1 in a billion. Even like really,
1 in a trillion.
Yeah, what really pessimistic, like someone who's really, really pessimistic would say 1 in a trillion. Well, if you are that pessimistic, it means it's happened 10 billion times.
So if you think, again, that's an amazing idea.
Yeah.
If you think what happened here, that life formed and developed into something intelligent and technological is 1 in a trillion. Even with all the perfect conditions we have for life, distance, if you think it's 1 in a trillion, it's happened 10 billion times in other places.
And think about what that means. Because we're not just talking about life. We're not just talking about, like, you know, leaves or something floating on. We're talking about full-blown civilization. So that means that even if you're so, you know, you just are so pessimistic that you think it's 1 in a trillion times, 10 billion civilizations, 10 billion histories of a species, you know, whatever they look like, they're ant-like, or they're, you know, they look like duckbill platypus, whatever, coming to intelligence, beginning to develop fire, beginning to develop silicon chips.
Like NASCAR, you know? Fantasy.
NASCAR, movies. Right. And like 10 billion, you could spend the rest of your life trying to draw each of these creatures, right, with your imagination, and it would take you more than your entire lifetime to come up with 10 you know, billion sentient, imagine 10 billion sentient species. So it's just like, it just staggers me when I think about this.
Okay. I'm curious to know, if you ever think you're going to hear from Frank Drake, who again is now in his mid-80s and still talks to SETI once in a while, and his equation, people have kind of fooled with it a number of times over the years. I've never seen anything quite like what Adam Frank and his co-author have done with this. You think you're going to hear from Frank?
I actually have been meaning to send him the paper. Yeah, it'd be nice to have a conversation with him. I've talked with other people, you know, in the biz, right? There's, you know, astrobiologists. So, I've talked with a number of them while I was doing the paper, and then also I've heard from, you know, various people. The thing about the Drake equation that's so awesome is that it became, you know, what he created for us was a way of scientifically discussing the problem, you know, a way of breaking the problem down. So right now I'm working on a popular book on this subject. And I'm reading a really great book about the Drake equation done by scientists that looks at what were the values people thought before 1961 and what were the values for each one of these seven terms and what were the values after 1961, which is when Drake came up with the equation. And, you know, it just shows how influential Drake's schema was, you know, his framework. He gave us a framework for talking about extraterrestrial civilizations in a way that beforehand it was just kind of craziness. Nobody even really knew how to, you know. So he created a paradigm, basically, for us to talk about the question.
Well, I want to listen to one more comment from Frank Drake then. And again, if you're just joining us, we're talking to Adam Frank, astrophysicist at the University of Rochester and the co-author of a new paper that puts this number on the possibility of intelligent life having ever existed elsewhere in the universe. Not necessarily right now, but ever. And the idea is that if you think we are one in a trillion here with all the right conditions, if you replicated this a trillion times, a trillion other Earths, it would only happen once. Well, then there are 10 billion other technological civilizations. It's an amazing number, but that's the work they've been doing to modify this equation. And Frank Drake's the creator of the equation. He did it in 1961, and here he was in 2012 talking to SETI. Now, in this clip you're about to hear, he opens by saying, there are 10,000 places you can arrive at. Here's what he means. He was asked by someone in this crowd, so what do you really think? How many active civilizations do you think there are now? And he kept stressing, we don't know. We can't really know. I can't. But he said, in my mind, the number I've always come back to is 10,000. 10,000 active civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy.
Right, in our galaxy.
Right now. And I think that was his way of saying, I don't know. I'm not saying that's definite. But what I'm saying is, based on all the parameters and everything we've had to work with, my guess is that's probably around what it would be. And here's what he talks about, the idea of trying to find it with those 10,000 active civilizations.
There are 10,000 places you could arrive at and find a civilization. But that means only one in every 10 million stars has a detectable civilization. So there are lots of them, but it will take a lot of searching. And this is the big challenge to our SETI program, why we need to do much more than we do, why we need much more money, because we need to search literally millions of stars before we'll have a high probability of succeeding. Now, we may luck out, you know, people do win the lottery by buying two tickets or so, but, and what we're doing here is really playing the lottery.
What do you think, Adam?
Well, I think, you know, the thing about, in general, like, so that number 10,000, he's just kind of pulling that out.
Sure, he admits it.
Yeah, and those are the bias, which is fine, right? So, but the question of, we have to do SETI, right? We have to do SETI because no matter what the work that, you know, we've done in our new paper, you know, unless you go out and look, you know, you don't know. And it's true, SETI, so, you know, people talk about the Fermi paradox, and I don't actually think the Fermi paradox is a paradox because we haven't really looked. We've barely begun to look.
Now, hold on. You mentioned the Fermi paradox.
Yeah.
Let's define the term again. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. So the Fermi paradox comes from this very amazing little lunch that one time a bunch of scientists in Los Alamos were having. And Enrico Fermi, the great Nobel Prize winning physicist, they've been talking about UFO sightings. You know, and so, you know, they go to lunch and they were chatting about it. And then after a while, they're on to something else. And suddenly Fermi says, well, where are they all? Right. And that was so it was Fermi's insight to recognize, like, well, wait a minute, shouldn't they, you know, if life is happening all the times and it becomes intelligent, shouldn't they even be here already?
Shouldn't we have seen somebody out there?
Shouldn't we have seen somebody?
Where is everybody?
Right. And so but I don't think that's really much of a paradox, because you could still be pretty optimistic and still not have them ever be here. Right. Sometimes it's like, well, why aren't they here already? And also it still could be that it's just it's, you know, you have to search through a lot of stars. There's a lot of stars out
there. And
there's
still a whole lot that we can't see in the universe, right?
Well, in some, it depends on what you say can't see. I mean, we can see stars. I mean, so we think life happens around on planets. That's as far as we
know.
But
how much can we see of the known universe?
A good chunk of it, you know? I mean, you know, there's different wavelengths. Here's the real question, I think, from what you're saying, is when we say see, right, should we be looking in radio? Or should we be looking maybe with directed energy beams, right? So this idea that, like, alien civilizations are going to use radio, like, why would they do that? We're almost done with radio, right?
I mean,
No. I mean, saying, like, how many people right now are getting this over the internet, right? Over a cable.
That's right.
Or over, you know, some other
mechanism. We shouldn't assume that if we're going to find a signal, it's going to be a radio signal.
I mean, a radio signal, right? There's a lot of wavelengths out there that you could use. Like,
sure.
Now people, you know, if you look for, we've learned so much since 1951 that it may make a lot more sense to do interstellar communication with lasers. You can pack a lot more energy and have it be focused over a much more tightly using lasers. So maybe we should be doing a search for laser communications. So that's what I mean. It's really about the wavelength. So, you know, we've looked so, you know, we haven't done the kind of search that we need to do even close yet to be able to say, like, wow, you know, we haven't found anybody. The universe is silent. Anybody who says that the universe is silent is like hasn't really been paying attention to what little progress we've made in actually being able to do the search.
Listeners, if you have any questions or comments on all this, we're having some fun. You can call the program and get in on this. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Matt on Twitter says, I'm not at all interested in astronomy or astrophysics, but listening to Adam Frank talk so passionately with Evan Dawson is amazing. Kate says, what's that number again? Billion, trillion times 10? You're blowing my mind. Love this show. So for Kate, what's the number again?
It's the odds. For us to be the only time it's ever happened, 1 in 10 billion trillion.
I keep laughing when that comes up because that's what I'm like, come on. Tom on Twitter says, on Earth, we argue about bathrooms and we presume intelligence. Adam Frank extends our minds to the edges of human thought. Humbling. Mm. That's very nice. And let me grab a question from Jake that I think is a good question. And it's a lengthy one, but it's a good one. Jake writes, I'm a big fan of Adam Frank, and I love these discussions as they can lead to new ways of looking at things. But the problem with the Fermi paradox, as I've seen it, has always been a lack of real data. The only thing I can personally guarantee is that any number anyone comes up with will be wrong. Does Adam think this is just fun, more useful, or something that waters down science? I worry a little with the time spent on more speculative studies about exoplanets, for example. Too much of science leaning toward flashy fluff rather than where the real money needs to go, which is nitty-gritty, boring data collection. That's from Jake.
That's a good question, Jake. I think, you know, he's also means both the Fermi paradox and the Drake equation in
sure,
general.
Absolutely.
They sort of seem to be together. But first let me say, you know, he brings up, like, the exoplanets. And I just want to assure him that the work on exoplanets is full of boring, dry, grinding science. And so that's the thing. Exoplanets, the work we've done on exoplanets, I mean, it's mind-blowing what we're able to do now, like full-blown science, small error bars. So we are now entering an era where we can characterize the atmospheres of planets orbiting other stars, right? So there's this, what they call the transit method, where, you know, we've been detecting you may have heard of the Kepler satellite. And the way the Kepler detects exoplanets is that we can see the planet pass in front of the star, and we see the starlight go blip, it drops a little bit. And there's a few minutes there where it's just the atmosphere, you know, the limb of the planet is passing in front of the star, and the starlight has to pass through the atmosphere before it gets to us. And that imprints on the light the fingerprint of the chemicals that are in the atmosphere. So we can actually tell what these atmospheres of these planets that are, you know, 10, 20, 100 light years away, we can tell what they're made of. We can tell if there's sulfur in the atmosphere or whether there's CO2. And soon, in the next 20, 30 years, we are going to have the accuracy to be able to tell whether there are biomarkers there, whether there are, you know, elements that tell us that there's a biosphere on those planets.
A biosphere, first of all, we think we know what it is. Let's define what a biosphere is and what the marker would be.
Okay, so a biosphere is, you know, when you go out and you know, we live in a really nice place to see biospheres, right? We're far enough north that we are in boreal forest territory, right? If you go out to Mendon Ponds, you're seeing a boreal forest, right? And all those trees, all interacting with each other, have, and then, you know, you go on a global scale, they have completely changed the planet. They have changed the chemistry of the planet's atmosphere. There would be no oxygen in the planet's atmosphere if it wasn't for all the life. right? So the biosphere is all of the life and all of the ways it's interacting. The plankton, the plants on the ground or on the dry land. They have reshaped the evolution of the planet, and so they're leaving traces. So the atmosphere. So for example, one potential biomarker is oxygen. If life went away tomorrow, the oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere would combine, would bind, and would be out of the atmosphere in, you know, centuries. I'm not actually sure what the exact number is, but, you know, on a pretty short time scale. So the fact that we have oxygen in the atmosphere for some people is an indication that, like, oh yeah, there's life going on there. So what we're trying to figure out now, people are doing very solid, very serious and very boring work in terms of what you have to do to figure out what are the biomarkers. What should we be looking for? Because it's something like people talk about methane, right? Life produces a lot of methane, but geochemistry also produces a lot of methane. So if you see methane in an exoplanet's atmosphere, does that mean life, or does it mean you have plate tectonics going on? So that right now, there's a lot of work. There was a great paper that just came out by Sarah Seeger a couple days ago where they tried to, you know, make an inventory of all the molecules that we think could only be formed by life that might show up in an atmosphere.
All right. So there is a lot of nitty-gritty data collection. But to Jake's point, there is an element of speculation or at least confidence, pessimism, optimism.
Well, not in the exoplanet.
Not in the exoplanet.
Right. But in the Drake equation.
And in the new Drake equation, right. In the Frank equation.
Well,
calling your equation, by the way?
We call it the A form. Of the Drake equation.
Come on, that's not. Give me a ring.
Because archaeology, it's the archaeological version.
Okay. Right,
that's what A stands for. Because we're just saying we have no idea whether any of these civilizations are around anymore, you know, because we've taken the line, you know. So what we're talking about is the archaeology.
And the A part was not related to the Drake equation. That's what makes it new as well.
Right. So, that we're thinking about it this way. Actually, though, somebody, as typical, right? So we published the paper, we're like, woohoo, we did this new thing. And then somebody like sent me a paper that would have been published in a journal, one page paper in 1976 that actually at least had the basic idea. They didn't do what we did, but they still sort of had this archaeological idea. So it was like, wah, wah, wah.
Well, they didn't have all of your information that you had to work with.
That's the main thing. They didn't have the data then. And so that's why, to answer Jake's question, Jake, the answer we're getting about this pessimism line is not, there's no speculation in this. There's zero speculation. This is, and that's what I think, that's why I'm really excited about this result. This is like a fully, this is one of the first fully empirical results that, you know, we've been able to get out of this question of, are we alone? And it's a weird, you know, the result, it may not be the result you want. All we're doing is we're setting a limit on the probability, but I think, you know, there's some information in that, but it is absolutely based on data.
And so now, if you want to ask the question, what are the likelihood that we're alone, we now have a number for it.
I think that's yes, absolutely. I will argue there's no speculation in this. If you ask this question, there is a data-driven answer to it.
And Jake, let me follow up before I get to some more listener feedback. I see the phone ringing, and I know there's so much interest in this. A lot of great questions coming in. We'll get to those. But let me just add, Jake, part of my own interpretation of this, because having gotten to know Adam, you know, again, so much of Adam's work in recent years has been looking at climate, which is interesting for an astrophysicist, but Adam is someone who is very much concerned with where the future of this planet is going from an astrobiological perspective. And so this equation doesn't prove that we are not alone or that we are not unique. But what it shows you is it seems very unlikely, unless you're a big pessimist, as Adam said.
You have to be a hyper-pessimist.
You got to be a hyper-pessimist. And if you then say, well, then we're likely not unique, and we're not alone, even if we never prove it, we can have some solidarity with the fact that there is a graveyard of civilizations out there in the universe, and we are heading in that direction unless we make some good decisions.
Yeah.
And there is value in feeling that solidarity that says we're not the only ones who've gone through feedback loops and increasing in population and energy and what happens to a planet's atmosphere when you consume more. And we've got to make some good decisions if we don't want to just join the rest. That's how I view your work.
Right. We don't want to end up on the cosmic loser list, right?
Is that part of what you're going?
This paper came out of the paper Woody and I did 2 years ago, which we talked about on the show, where we were trying to frame what is going on right now with climate change and sustainability in an astrobiological perspective. It was actually out of that we figured out we stumbled on this result. And what we're truly saying there is that we're not the only time that this has happened, right? And so that we actually had to show that was true. What we wanted to show was that It's a reasonable argument to say that, you know, many species have gone through what we're going through now. And we can actually, what we want to do is actually model it, is simulate it, to try and get, at least get a theoretical handle on what that average longevity is, right? If I can actually model this and do some simulations and find out if my models tell me that, like, the average lifetime is 200 years, that's kind of disturbing. But if the average lifetime is 1 million years, that says there's some wiggle room, and, you know, that will help us understand what our decisions might be. And finally, that whole course won't make any sense unless it's reasonable to say this has happened a lot of times, so that there are averages. Averages are meaningful. Patterns in the way species evolve are exist.
Angela writes to the program, she wishes that she had Adam teaching her physics or calculus classes, and she wants to know, where can listeners read your paper on this?
Actually, it got a fair amount of attention. So, you know, if you just did, like, if you Google Adam Frank Drake equation,
you're going to find a lot.
Yeah, you'll find, because it got good coverage, so I was happy about it. And then that'll lead you directly to the paper, too.
Yeah, international coverage. You'll find plenty of stuff. Short break, and then we come back to our listeners who've been waiting. Keith, Brian, Chris, Gary want to weigh in with their own questions and comments on this. With Adam Frank, University of Rochester astrophysicist, the new A-form equation, the modern version of the Drake equation. Your questions are next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, Jenny Romer is an attorney recently featured in The New Yorker. She's traveling the country, essentially trying to change plastic bag laws. She wants them banned in New York City and in other cities. Well, how about Rochester and the Finger Lakes? We'll check in on plastic bag laws. Then in our second hour, heroin, addiction, and asking insurance to cover the costs. We'll talk about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. One thing we've learned today, and you don't have to be an astrophysicist to understand this idea. The next time someone says, come on, what are the odds that we're actually alone? You can tell them that modern science, thanks to Adam Frank and his co-author, Woody Sullivan, tells us that we are alone if we are the only ones out of 10 billion trillion possible planets that could sustain life just like ours. And if you are a big-time pessimist, then maybe you believe that. And that's what we've been learning here. I want to grab Keith in Farmington first up. Go ahead, Keith.
I had a very interesting show. I also would love to see if you could get a show with an professor on light energy, because I got a really important question to ask one. I don't know where to find it. But back to the topic. You're going to be looking for planets that may have already died out. But, I mean, aren't we doomed to extinction? Because isn't the sun's energy finite? And secondly, maybe how the oceans have kept America relatively safe between world wars. Isn't the vastness of space maybe very beneficial?
Yeah.
I mean, if we do find somebody, they may not be as tolerant as we are. I'm using air quotes on that for sure.
Keith, it is a great question. Angela actually sent an email saying, what do we do if we see a sign of life? But to Keith's point, maybe we don't want to find life.
Yeah, this is a really interesting. So let's see with the first one. You know, the sun, all stars have finite lifetimes. But, you know, the sun has at least 5 billion years left before it burns out. But, you know, but the sun is continually slowly heating up, very slowly. So probably the Earth is only going to be able to be habitable for maybe another billion years or so. That's a really interesting idea. So that's one thing. To your point about, like, really, should we be letting anybody know that we're here, right? This has been a big debate about whether or not maybe we should be hiding, right? We shouldn't be sticking our heads out from, you know, the hidey hole. And right now we're just beaming stuff into space, being like, hey, we're here, we're tasty. And, you know, I think that really deserves a that's Stephen Colbert who did that. But, you know, I think that really deserves some attention. I think we should maybe think about being careful. You know?
Well, wasn't it Carl Sagan, who helped design one of the first messages to space that we were sending out?
Yeah, that was Sagan, who put on, you know, put the plaques on the Pioneer and the record on Voyager.
Like a little stick figure guy, like, hey, if you find us, here we are.
Here we are, we're naked.
Our weaknesses are, you know, country music or whatever it is. But so that is an interesting idea. And Angela's question, what would you do if you found a sign of life? What should we do?
Well, okay, there's life and there's intelligent life. I mean, I think just fine. If we found a biomarker, that would be an epic-making discovery, right? And then all kinds of stuff would flow out of that, you know. But if we found, like, imagine if we found a signal that clearly indicated intelligence. Again, that would be epic-making and wild. And the question, though, is what would come out of that? Because this is why I think the A-form, this equation we did, is so important. Because on one level, the distance between stars is so large that, you know, let's say we found intelligence, you know, we found a signal coming from, you know, 400 light years away, right? Which is very small distance on galactic scales. That means, you know, what, we'd send a message back and be like, hey, nice hearing from you. And then it would take 400 years for it to get to them. And then another 400 years for them to go like, hey, nice hearing from you too. Right. So it's like 800 years between, you know, I mean, it's bad enough trying to have a conversation on email back and forth over a week, right? So that's, to me, that's why I think it would change human society, but you know, it would still, there wouldn't be anything immediate that was going to come out of that unless they landed on the White House lawn, right? That's a different thing.
And interestingly, as Adam says, you know, it could be 800 years. 800 years is both an eternity for a technological civilization still figuring out if we can continue to exist.
Right.
And it is nothing in the long-term scale of time.
Of cosmos, of the universe, yeah. Right.
You know, it's just tiny... so interesting to think of time that way. But which is why, you know, back to Keith going, well, isn't the sun going to burn out eventually? Yeah, we may only have a billion years left with the sun. We may have five. And who knows what can happen between now and then. So the answer is we're not going to have the sun forever.
Right.
We've got it for a while longer, and then who knows how technological we can get. One of the ideas is technological civilizations beat the collapse of their star by going elsewhere before it.
Spread out. But it's so, I mean, listen, all of human history is compressed into 10,000 years, right? It's only been 10,000 years since the last ice age. And 10,000 years compared to a billion is a very small time scale. So it's like, it would be amazing for us if we lasted another 10,000 years, right? It's hard enough to even imagine 400 years ago. You know, it's hard enough to imagine the Renaissance. Now trying to imagine 10 times that, 100 times that, 1,000 times that. What would we even look like in, 10,000 years? As a, biologically, what would we look like, especially given what we're doing with technology?
And here we are on a tangent, but I've just got, I mean, this steers me right back into thinking about one of the big problems of poverty. Because people who live in poverty, it is not their responsibility to figure out climate change and sort of sustainable living. They're trying to get by.
Right.
They're trying to provide for their children.
Right.
So the more poverty you have on a planet, the less likely that civilization is to be able to think truly long term.
Right.
Not 10 years
right.
or 30 or 50, but to think sustainably to provide the kind of planet that you can live on.
Right.
And that's another reason that we've got to try to eradicate poverty, is it not?
What we're going through right now, this is the main thing that I'm trying to communicate with this work in some sense, is that what we are experiencing right now is not just some kind of political thing about Democrats versus Republicans, or it's not just something singular like, oh, wow, this is happening to us. You know, my argument is this has happened many, many times before. And what this constitutes is a sea change in the evolution of the planet, right? We're not just human beings. We're an expression of the planet. The planet has had dinosaurs. It has had, you know, giant sea creatures. You know, the planet has been running these experiments in evolution throughout its 5 billion year history. And we are one of those experiments. And yet we're unique in that kind of experiment in terms of our feedback on the planet. And, you know, either we evolve to figure out how to make the next step, or the planet moves on without us. And I'm firm in my belief, and it's a belief, that this has happened many times before. And as species either make it because they figure out, you know, what is required to think on 100,000-year timescales, or they just can't work it out, and they just, you know, the planet moves on.
All right, let me get some more listener questions in for astrophysicist Adam Frank. Gary says, much of the universe is comprised of dark matter. Can there be dark matter civilizations?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is most likely no, because dark matter doesn't clump. Right? It's ridiculous for us to call, you know, us normal matter, because we constitute such a small fraction of, you know, but
we're probably the abnormal matter.
We're the abnormal matter. Yes. Yeah, right. So dark matter is really the normal matter. But our kind of abnormal matter, we have the ability to clump into like tight, dense shapes. And that's what actually allows all the interesting kind of biochemistry to happen. So the most you can do with a dark matter is make a big puffy cloud the size of a galaxy. So you can't really get much more substructure than that. But it's a really excellent question.
It's like Smoke Monster Lost. You know, you're not going to have a civilization
right.
of that. Yeah.
Smoke
okay. And he also asks, if by string theory there are multiple parallel dimensions, what of civilizations in those dimensions?
Well, you know, first of all, I have to say I'm not a big fan of string theory. It's been 30 years of string theory. If I see one more talk on string theory where somebody tells like, oh, and we're on the verge of, you know, I'm like, no, you promised me that 25 years ago. I think string theory has exhausted itself. And same thing with multiple parallel dimensions. I mean, it's the coolest science fiction idea ever, but I'm just not a big fan of it. But if there were, like, if there were, you know, then yeah, sure. Then and also, when that number that we calculated, that was based on the observable universe.
Yeah, that's
right?
Not based on string theory.
Or I'm not that, I even forget string theory. You know, we think the universe is infinite. Right?
Okay.
Our best theories right now, and the data show that the universe is infinite. But there's only a part of it that we can see, that we can get signals from. So our calculation was based on that part that we can see. You know, the universe is infinite, which means actually, you know, there's infinite number of planets. So, okay, now it has to have happened before. So if you take into the, I can't say anything about the parts of the universe we don't get signals from because we, you know, it's possible they could be different because I don't have any signals from them.
This would be like somebody in the year, I don't, like 12, right? It's the year 12 AD, and you're standing in Missouri, and you're ordering coffee at Starbucks, but you've got no way to get to Europe, and you go, I have no idea if Europe exists.
Yeah,
like,
right.
I mean, like, who? It's just an idea.
Yeah, right. There could be a Europe with people.
There might be an Australia.
Pizza. And,
how do
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
So okay, we're getting to see a little bit more of it, but there's still so much we haven't seen. Judy writes to us and says, I believe that there is intelligent life in the galaxy. There has to be, as there are so many stars. Hopefully, less violent than the quote intelligent beings here on Earth. Find them soon, please. So there's a vote for finding them.
Right, right.
Do you have hope that a civilization that could actually be detected by us, which would almost inherently be more advanced than us, could be benevolent? Maybe.
Yeah, sure. Actually, I think, you know, I mean, you know, it's again, this is just, always the problem. Well, everything I'm trying to do in my work is eliminate the sociology because, you know, anything you say about it turns out to be a science fiction movie, right? You know, a science fiction script. I would certainly hope that in order to do the things, the evolution you need in your social interactions to actually, because obviously you're not going to deal with climate change, that, you know, the change you're making to the planet without some kind of, you know, massive collective effort. I think that part you can sort of say, you know, somewhat definitively. And so the collective effort is going to require a kind of shift in your society where you're able to get the individuals to work together. So, you know, that may be very advantageous. It doesn't necessarily seem that they're not going to come and want to eat us, right? I mean, because they may work very well together, but so, I mean, that part is anybody's guess whether they're, and that goes back to this question of should we be hiding or not. I don't think we should guess that they're more, you know, they have higher morals, because who knows what their moral standards are, you know?
And how to apply what a real moral standard even means.
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking to Adam Frank, astrophysicist, who's the co-author of a new paper, The A-Form Equation. We're talking about an update of the famous Drake Equation from 1961, and Adam and his co-author have produced a paper that looks at the possibility of life having ever existed, and I mean life in the intelligent technological form, a technological civilization, not how many exist right now, but how many have ever existed. And what they have determined, using a number of factors, is that the odds are, we don't have to talk about odds, there is a number. If the human race is alone, there have been at least 10 billion trillion other opportunities for life to evolve in the same way that we did, and it's just never happened. And what Adam is saying is you got to be a really big pessimist to think that it never has.
Yeah, I kind of consider this to be like a proof by exhaustion, right? I mean, that with that number is so crazy that you just have to be like a militant pessimist to say that with the 10 billion trillion opportunities, it didn't happen in any of them. I'm like, come on, you know.
So there will be those, though, who say,
yes.
You got to show me.
Yeah. And that's a reasonable thing. But I mean, I'm saying just, you know, like I said, it's an argument by exhaustion that, you know, one has to really configure, one has to like really go out of your way to argue that all the different possibilities that lead to a intelligent technological civilization would be so unlikely as to add up to one in 10 billion trillion.
On Twitter, one of our listeners, Monica, just wanted to know, what does Drake think of the updated equation? As we said, Monica, we don't know that Frank Drake has seen it yet. He might. He's in his mid-80s, living in Chicago, still talks to SETI once in a while. So we'll see. But I'm also curious, Adam, based on Monica's question, what are your colleagues saying? What kind of feedback are you getting in your own science community?
I've gotten, pretty good feedback. People are interested, in what we're doing. I think people understand what, the reviewer, right? You know, it's a scientific paper. We had sent it to a journal. The journal sent it to, referee. The referee was like, oh, this is cool, I think everybody, I haven't gotten like pushback really on it. People are asking questions about their, they're asking me about what the best way to think about it and such is. So overall, it's pretty good. There still is, though, we're still at this point where, thinking about exo-civilizations. That's the term I like, exo-civilizations. It's still a little bit like, come on, do you really want to do that? But I think it's time to stop doing that. My new thing is, it's time to stop snickering about aliens, right? Because we always kind of, a little while back, the Kepler, some company was looking at the Kepler data, and they found these really unusual signals in it. They said, look, this could be an alien megastructure, orbiting. And everyone's like, oh, and I think it's time to stop doing that, because, given everything we're doing with looking at these planets in detail, it's possible we're going to come across something like that. Unlikely, but possible, and we should start, at least prepare for the possibility to,
What Adam is talking about, one of the researchers behind that data is Tabitha Boyajian, and she just did a TED Talk, and that TED Talk just got published a couple of weeks ago. Easy to find. It's on the most mysterious star in the galaxy, and it's about 1,500 light years away. It's a long way away, but not that far. Is 1,500 light years, is that a long way away?
No, it's not a long way away. Yeah. No.
So the neat thing about that star is they still don't know what it is that caused those funky variations in light. But in this case, they had these citizen scientists who were kind of volunteering to check out the data, and they kept seeing this star that... the light is generally pretty constant from a star. Sometimes there's fluctuations because a planet will pass in front. Sometimes a comet will pass in front. Something weird will happen, and then they'll figure it out. In this case, the light dropped by like 80% or something really wild for a sustained amount of time, and then it went back to sort of normal. And they're going, what is it that passed in front of this thing? And they couldn't figure it out. Planets didn't really make sense. And then they thought, well, maybe it's got to be comets, maybe broken up comets, those kind of thing. And then they figured out it would have had to have been something like 400,000 comets, which is just never heard of. Possible, but very, very unlikely. So they still don't know. One of the fun ideas is it's a Dyson swarm. A Dyson swarm being just an idea. This is in the family of ideas never proven. But if a civilization can use all of the power of its host star, it would need to build technology that would basically surround the star and pull the energy off that star. And so maybe this is like a bombed out Dyson shell, like this is a civilization that existed eons ago, and we're seeing what was left of it, or maybe it moved. And Adam's point, I remember reading Adam right after that, was saying, hey, stop snickering. It's probably not.
Right.
No one is saying it definitely is.
Right.
But we have to prepare for the idea that eventually we may see something like that.
And be ready to sort of prove or disprove that. So we have to do the theoretical work to sort of say, like, what would something like that look like? So we can, because we're already looking at planets with that's why I was talking about with the atmospheric characterization. We're looking at planets now. We're preparing to be looking at thousands, hundreds of thousands of planets in excruciating detail. So we may just, chance upon. And here's a cool thing, right? Let me ask you a question. How do we know that, like, some giant tree sloth from 200 or 20 million years ago didn't form a civilization? How do you know, though? There hasn't been an intelligent species that existed in the past.
Here? Right here?
Yeah. Right. Because we think, like, oh, there would be buildings around, there'd be artifacts. Well, 20 million years ago is long enough that actually there wouldn't be any artifacts left, right? The only way we'd be able to tell is maybe if there were, like, weird isotopic signatures. Like, if we'd go tomorrow, in 20 million years, there won't be a single building. There won't even be a trace of a building left, right?
But there are bones. There are bones from 65 million years ago.
There, it's possible. Whether or not you would fossilize your pieces of your civilization, that's not clear. A lot of that could get ground up, So it's not clear that you would necessarily see us. So I'm just saying, the reason I'm saying this is that the what would survive, though, is space stuff. If it was in a stable orbit, that stuff would still be there. So I'm just I'm raising it for that point.
Dude, this is like melting my brain. This is like the phone calls coming from inside the house. Like, you know, where is the other civilization out there? It's right here.
It was right here. No, that's like a freak. I'm not saying that's true. I don't believe that. But I'm saying, like, somebody brought this up to me. Gavin Schmidt from the Goddard Institute for Space Study brought this idea up to me. I was like, dude, that is like the freakiest idea I've ever heard.
The Statue of Liberty on the beach, man. You know, I mean, like, that's, oh my gosh.
You blew it up.
don't mistake what we're saying for saying that that's likely or that Adam Frank believes that. The point being, there's so much to discover that's out there, and we're almost out of time with Adam Frank as we've been talking about the publication of his new paper that he co-authored on the updated Drake equation. It's the A-form equation, and it takes a look at the possibility, the likelihood or the unlikelihood, that pessimism line of how likely it is that we are the only technological civilization that has ever existed. The one question I've got left then would be this. Life, we're not talking about sort of single cell lives, amoeba, things like that. I mean, almost certainly throughout the universe, that stuff has happened.
I mean, there's arguments to be made for that.
Someone may say to you, life has existed all over the universe, but we have never seen it jump to something intelligent the way it has here. And that is the line. The line is not 1 in 10 billion trillion. The line is, show me that that could happen again. There's no reason to think that it could. There may be reason to think that this was a freak event. And that could be, you know, as we talk about the great filter or whatever. What makes you think that that's not likely, you know, impossible?
Well, again, in the equation, what we did, we lumped all the probability terms together. So that number is for civilizations, right? That number, that limit is for, you know, that
right.
is a limit.
It's not for amoeba.
It's not for amoeba. It is for civilization. So that 1 in 10 billion trillion is for, like, you know, species that evolved up to the point that they are building radio telescopes and they have energy-intensive civilizations
right.
there. So, you know, so I think it's still possible that it may be rare. Like, you can, this is the thing about this. You can still be pessimistic.
And this is where I define rare in this case, the universe is so big, rare even
exactly.
means a lot.
Right, right. Even if it's rare, even it may be that there right now there's no active civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy now. But that still doesn't mean it hasn't happened in the universe or even the Milky Way lots of times in the past.
And how many, where are the Milky Way galaxies? How many galaxies exist in the universe?
Oh my God, there's like 100 billion. each one has, you know, 300 billion stars.
We've had some fun this hour, but I want to very sincerely congratulate you on this work. And I know the scientific community, like you said, has had to review it and take a look at it. It very well could end up in my son's 4. He could go to school and have it in a textbook, citing your work on at least the pessimism line. It's very possible.
I don't know.
Congratulations on that.
Well, thank you.
Adam Frank, if you just Google Adam Frank Drake equation, you can learn a lot more about it. And our great thanks to him and the University of Rochester. Thanks for listening. Kat Schwarz is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful afternoon. We'll talk to you on Wednesday.